And good afternoon, Indie Bay. You're listening to Indie Bay Radio in San Francisco. And we've done a series of interviews throughout this campaign year with candidates running for political office throughout the state and nation. And today we've got Todd Kreshen. He's the candidate in California for U.S. Senate. He'd be running against Dianne Feinstein. And my God, is she... She's never been a liberal, although she tried to portray herself as such maybe about 30 years ago. And, of course, the boundaries have changed. I think a famous old theory of Richard Nixon's political theory was that if you change the center, then the Democrats will always look like losers or something like that. So... what Dianne Feinstein was 30 years ago has certainly changed today. Well, welcome, Todd. Tell us about you, and then why don't you talk about your opponent?
It's hard to describe Dianne Feinstein and not run into problems with the FCC. But I'm a longtime anti-war activist, been an organizer with the International Socialist Organization for a long time, worked on Ralph Nader's campaigns and Medea Benjamin's campaigns and Peter Camejo's and the Green Party. So I quite proudly have no legislative experience, and I think that probably the worst thing you can do to prepare for going into the Congress or Senate is to have legislative experience, because what passes for that these days is just many different ways to defend the status quo. So folks listening to this broadcast probably know that Dianne Feinstein voted to send our troops to Iraq. She has voted for every Pentagon expenditure to keep them there, voted for Patriot Act 1, like that one so much she voted for Patriot Act 2. She's against gay marriage, is a supporter of the No Child Left Behind Act, and on and on and on and on. And of course, most recently, Senator Feinstein's claim to fame is organizing a pro-Israel rally in downtown San Francisco about a week and a half ago. And this is the first time that Senator Feinstein has ever taken a position publicly in a protest about a war in San Francisco. Of all the anti-war protests that have happened in San Francisco in the last few years, she has never stepped foot near one. And she chose to make her debut appearing as the headline speaker in the pro-war rally, cheering on Israel as it carpet bombs Lebanon and maintains, it's hard to say, reorganizes, but maintains its continuing occupation and bloodbath in Gaza. So I think the differences are very clear between my candidacy and hers, and if people are looking for a way to cast a protest vote against Senator Feinstein's pro-war, pro-corporate politics, they should check out my website at www.toddforsenate.org. And you can get more information there. I always need help, volunteers, donations, and happy to answer questions as well.
Yeah, well, that's great. And are you able to get some campaign headquarters going? You know, L.A. would be a good one. San Diego, I'd hope. San Francisco Bay Area. Have you got local offices set up?
We've got... we've got an office here in San Francisco, and then there's a lot of the Green Party has offices across the state, which many of them are generously sort of letting us, you know, work out of. And as I'm sure people are aware, the expenses of a campaign like this in a state this big are fairly overwhelming. So we're really trying to keep the apparatus pretty light so that we can spend our money on materials to get out to the public, and to really concentrate on trying to get the word out and organize in the grassroots rather than sort of setting up a whole series of very expensive offices. So our emphasis has been on people power over money power.
Sure. Well, so if people are listening throughout the city, or excuse me, throughout the state, if you get in touch with your local Green Party headquarters, that'd be a good place to start to get literature and find volunteer meetups of one type or another. And let's see, obviously you made it through the primary in June, so there are a slate of green candidates, and most counties are going to be putting together their own slate card, putting together voter registration drives after Memorial Day after Labor Day is the big push for candidates to do the final run into November. And so this idea of needing volunteers to get out there and do the hard work to not only get Greens elected, but we've got a lot of issues that are facing us, that are facing actually all third parties this year. The crooked voting machines that many counties are still locked into. We had hoped that Kevin Shelley, as Secretary of State, was at least talking about getting rid of these crooked voting machines. But once he was run out of office, his replacement, Bruce McPherson, a Republican from down in Santa Cruz area, from a publishing magnate family, he's decided not to work on changing out these Diebold machines and making certain that the Republicans have got a dishonest edge in the election this year. So it's a very important thing for people to maintain their push to make sure that there are honest elections this November. So the Green Party is working toward that, and as we hope all third parties are, to make sure that the there are some honest elections. In fact, the Democrats apparently better get wise to this if they want to make any progress here. So tell us about your slate. You've got, obviously, the Green Party has got the 10 key values. What are your hot issues this year as you've been campaigning? What have people been asking you to cover?
Well, of course, as you said, many of the issues around the electoral fraud. We just saw a massive electoral fraud in Mexico. That's one issue, and I would only say that I think the character of our electoral fraud here in the United States is slightly different, in that it's I think it's genuinely bipartisan, and it starts not on election day, but it starts or continues years before with the massive amounts of corporate cash which just slosh around the mainstream Democrat and Republicans candidates and their campaigns. So there's been the electoral fraud, of course. The inability or the unwillingness of Nancy Pelosi and the Democratic Party to raise the question of impeaching George Bush. The No Child Left Behind, recently the massive movement for immigrants' rights, which has exploded onto our streets, has shown that we need an alternative people's party in this country. Remember when George Bush went on television in the run-up to the May 1st protests, and he demanded a bracero program, that is indentured servitude. He put troops on the border, and he wanted to split up families by deporting millions of people. And within 3 days, the Democrats in the Senate passed legislation by a vote in the Democratic caucus of 41-45. The Republicans split on it because there's a psycho wing of the Republicans that wants even harsher measures. But keep in mind that President Bush, the Chamber of Commerce, and 41 out of 45 Democratic senators want George Bush's anti-immigrant program. So immigrants' rights has become the most important mass movement, I think, in decades in this country, and it really holds the hope of a new generation of young workers beginning to build a different type of politics in this country. So immigrants' rights has been very, very important. And then, along with many other things, I just wanted to concentrate on the war, and I just want to say a few things about the war in Iraq. If I may. The anti-war movement in the last 3 years, if we take the long view, there was a massive anti-war movement in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, and people really believed that they could stop the invasion, and threw themselves into that protest movement, and we saw, you know, a million or more people take to the streets in February of 2003. Once George Bush and Congress ignored the people's will and went to war anyway, with Dianne Feinstein cheering George Bush on, there was a period of confusion, and we have had a period of confusion over the last 3 years in the anti-war movement. And part of that confusion stems from the sort of racist assumption in the United States that, of course, Arab and Muslim people can't work out their own affairs, and so they need Big Brother there to do it for them. It's just a recapitulation of the white man's burden, the old colonial policies. And so I think that has confused some people, number one. Number two, there has been this notion that somehow we can passively wait for George Bush to leave office through an election and replace him with Hillary Clinton, or maybe You know, I don't even know who else is going to put up. Al Gore. It seems like Al Gore thinks he can be president again, or maybe even John Kerry, incredibly enough. But this notion that changing the president of the United States changes the imperial policies of the United States actually has very little basis in American history. So if you look at the Vietnam War, John F. Kennedy started it, LBJ ramped it up, and Nixon finished it. And there was no, it's impossible to make any differentiation in American policy in Vietnam based on who was in power in the White House. And I believe that that is true today, because why we are in Iraq is not because of George Bush and his neocon friends. We are in Iraq because of the bipartisan consensus to control the oil of the Middle East. Not because most of the oil in this country comes from there. Most of it comes from Nigeria and comes from Venezuela. And we do get, you know, about 20%, 25% of our oil from the Middle East. But most of the oil from the Middle East goes to China, it goes to Japan, and it goes to the European Union. And those are the big economic competitors with our corporations. And so our corporations are happy to spill the blood of Arab people and of our young working class soldiers in order to maintain their control of the resources of the region. And that is true if it's George Bush or it's Bill Clinton or if it's going to be Hillary Clinton. So I think that notion, though, within the anti-war movement that the problem is Bush and if we can only get rid of him, which is why everybody, most of the anti-war movement got behind John Kerry in 2004, that notion is a very dangerous and paralyzing motion. And there's now a new phase in the war, which I think is beginning to break the logjam that we've had of passivity in the anti-war movement for the last couple of years, and that is the Israeli attack on Lebanon and Palestine. And the idea that many people in the anti-war movement have that these are two separate occupations, that somehow Israel is independent of the United States in this course of action, we really have to make clear that the United States and Israel are marching hand in hand with a 50-year policy of containing and dominating the people of the Middle East because there's oil there. And so this Israeli invasion and new occupation of Lebanon and the continuing siege of Gaza and now the threats against Syria and Iran are not some accidents. They're not some misguided politicians. They're not one thin layer of neocon theorists. They are the decades-long, dominant, overwhelmingly consensed policy of the American ruling class. And you only have to look at the vote that took place about 2 weeks ago in the Senate. There was a vote to back the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and Gaza. It was 100-0. In the Congress, the vote was 410-8. Even Barbara Lee abstained. To give you an idea of the power of that belief in America's right to control the oil. The only people who voted against it were John Conyers and a few of the other Democrats who are in Michigan and are very heavily, around very heavily Arab populations. And so their electoral calculations aren't thrown off so much by that. So we are in a situation where we have two parties of war. And the idea that switching one of these parties for the other is going to make any significant difference in the policies in the Middle East is a very dangerous idea. It's a paralyzing idea, and it's being put forward by people on the left who ought to know better. And I think that if we don't get over that, then the anti-war movement will be hamstrung for years to come, and that will mean more and more blood.
You know, it's interesting. You were talking about the economics of the oil, and you raised the idea that most of the oil that comes to America comes from Venezuela and Mexico and whatnot. And it is a given that most of the oil from the Middle East is not going to be coming to the United States. It's going to power the sweatshops of the Middle East. Or former Soviet bloc. It's going to go to Pakistan, India, and China. Those oil pipelines are going to go through Kashmir. And so the more so-called loyal patriotic Americans support this war, the more they're going to guarantee that there are going to be more sweatshops in the Middle East and Asia and former Soviet bloc to take the jobs out of America. So that's a horror of a dynamic. People claiming to be patriotic are actually watching their jobs leave America.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, if you look at the polls now, the big majority of people in the country are opposed to the war. They want the troops to come home. So I think that we've actually, the anti-war movement has done a very good job, and the Iraqi resistance has done a job, and the soldiers themselves, who are the Pew was it Pew or Zogby did a poll in Iraq, and 72% of the soldiers wanted to come with home within a year, and that poll was done 8 months ago. The new plan is to send more soldiers to Iraq. So the soldiers themselves, the Iraqi resistance and the anti-war movement has dramatically changed American opinion about it. So we now have big majorities against the war. So the problem is not the opinions of the American people. The problem is the capacity to organize a political movement that has enough strength to change the policies of this government. And that's where that argument about the Democrats, about the white man's burden, about the idea that simply changing the George Bush is going to change this policy comes into play. Because people who in their heart are genuinely against the war and they want the troops to leave and they want the people of Iraq to have their own future, they get fooled by, generally speaking, not Joe Lieberman and Dianne Feinstein, but they get fooled by, unfortunately, people like Barbara Lee, who come down and say, yes, I'm a Democrat, but we have to reform the Democratic Party. We have to take it back. Dennis Kucinich, who also voted abstain on the question of invading Lebanon, that if we don't form a new political party, even the best of the Democratic Party people who try hard to maintain their principles, they are disciplined by the real corporate powers of the Democratic Party. And so long as an anti-war movement is unable to understand the fact that the option of voting the war away by changing from the Republicans to the Democrats, so long as the movement thinks that that's an option, it means that it de-emphasizes things like mass protests, sit-ins on campuses, going and talking to the soldiers. It de-emphasizes the things that we actually know from the Vietnam War that can actually end the war. And so that's, I think, the argument is not just an abstract one, but it's about strategy and tactics in the anti-war movement.
Well, right. It's we're in a kind of an interesting position. The neocons have talked for years about market forces, and that the market forces should always win out. The government is supposed to be performing certain functions, and that the private industry can always handle things better than the people can. And strangely enough, if there's about a 70% market share for ending this war, you would think that 70% of the talk show hosts, 70% of staff at the neocon press should be swapped out pretty instantly, because market forces would say that that we should have a change out of these cheerleaders for the war. But it doesn't seem to work out that way.
Well, the free market is one of the greatest myths ever perpetrated on humankind. The free market began in England back in the 17th century with the clearing of the forests and the forcible expulsion of the peasantry. It continued with the enslavement of Africa, the extinction or the genocide against the American Indians in this country. And it has always been, especially in California, the free market. The economy was a creation of the military-industrial complex. California would not have an economy if it was not for massive state intervention, from the railroads to the defense industry. So the free market is a wonderfully powerful myth that the people who run this country apply to us, while they themselves apply the rules of how the economy actually works, which is about power, it's about class, and it's about using the state as an apparatus to defend that power and that privilege. And so, you know, it's a good point you make, but I think that if you ask most people in this country, you know, are you really happy with the free market, most people shake their heads and say, well, no, but what's the alternative? And then we get back to the question of, can we organize, we have strategy and tactics, what's the alternative?
Well, the old idea was one man, one vote, and it seems to me that whole free market myth is $1, one vote.
This is probably about right. It's $1, one vote pretty accurately runs the United States. And of course, if you do the numbers, that means that less than 1% of the population owns as much as 60% of the population. And that's about how the elections go. And really, the Democrats and the Republicans focus on what they call swing voters, the centrist voters. And what they really mean by that is people who generally make $80,000 to $100,000 a year and are not quite sure if they want this tax break or that tax break. And that's really the Republicans assume the Christian fundamentalist base. The Democrats take for granted the black and union vote and women's vote. And then they fight over a very, very thin layer of people who are not in the middle of American politics at all. It's a total myth. They're not in the center. They're far to the right of the center of what most people think. But in terms of the economy and who votes and all that sort of thing, that's how the elections are geared towards.
Sure. Now, it's kind of interesting. The 1776 theory would put it that we would get taxation with representation. Now, if the one man, one vote doesn't seem to exist, it's $1, one vote, and then the super rich, the 60% that have 1%, I think 2% owns something like 80% now, maybe even closer to 90. If the super rich aren't paying any taxes, yet it's a dollar a vote, how does that work out for actual elections? Is there a dynamic that we could pull so that those that don't pay taxes don't vote?
Those that don't pay taxes. Well, I think that that's a very good idea, and it's been tried places in the world, and I think we should try it again someday. But the reality is, I just want to make a final comment maybe on elections, because it's sort of funny. I'm a candidate. I'm running for Senate. And people should go to toddforsenate.org and help out with the campaign. But my belief is that the point of a campaign like this is not because I think I'm going to beat Dianne Feinstein and her $14 million or anything like that, but because the candidate can bring the issues and a discussion to what's much more important, which are the social movements, the labor movement, the immigrants' rights movement, the anti-war movement, and bring these debates into the movement so that at least a part of the movement can say, you know what, we're not going to be passive, we're not going to take a dive, we're not going to stand aside and put our movement on hiatus for 6 months because, well, we've got to do everything we can and we can't rock the boat so that we can ruin back the congressional midterm elections. But a candidate can come in and say, there is literally, honestly, no reason to vote for the Democratic Party. And the time you spend thinking about voting for the Democratic Party is time you ought to spend building independent politics and the mass movements, because that is the only thing that's ever changed anything. You raised 1776. People don't know this, the Declaration of Independence, there was the only reason it was passed was because the people of Philadelphia, in opposition to the big merchants of Philadelphia, dissolved the Philadelphia government, had an illegal assembly of armed workers in the town, and threatened to dump them in the bay if they didn't vote for the Declaration of Independence. And so right from the beginning of American history, the only thing that has fundamentally changed the direction of this country is mass protests, is a healthy disregard for the legal setup and for the current and longstanding electoral system. So that's really the point of my candidacy, is to be an uncandidate and say, don't vote for me thinking that I'm going to change things for you, but vote for me as part of a process in which you understand that only all of us together through a mass movement are going to change this country.
Yeah, there are many of these small races are actually very important. For example, we've got Forrest Hill as the Green Party candidate running for Secretary of State, and with the crooked voting machines, it's very important to make sure that the office of Secretary of State is handled by someone who has a vested interest in making sure that there are honest elections. If we know that these voting machines are rigged and the Democrats and Republicans are both dancing to the tune of the manufacturers of the machines, it's very clear that that is a linchpin race in California. If we want honest elections in the future, Forrest Hill would be a very smart choice to get in there. And in fact, throughout history, American history, as recently as back in the 80s when Jim Hightower was agriculture commissioner for Texas, he was the one that almost single-handedly and personally got America wised up to the problems with mad cow disease, with genetically modified foods, with getting the agricultural system cleaned up. Huey Long in Louisiana was a small race. It was, if I remember right, he was on the railroad board. And he single-handedly took on, I believe it was Standard Oil of Louisiana at the time, which has since become Exxon, and decided to charge them the true costs of transportation of oil out of Louisiana, and pretty much helped bust the trust of Louisiana or of Standard Oil, and force the issues of taxation with representation, that a state should be able to get the true costs of the development of the minerals and natural resources of the state. So third parties and small races are very much linchpins. So with any luck, I take it you're doing campaigning with many of the other candidates with the Green Party and third parties around the state?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on my way to Los Angeles this weekend to do some events down there. Matt Gonzalez is going to come down and we'll do some events. And then Chrissy Kiefer, who's running against Nancy Pelosi for the Green Party here in San Francisco, is doing a bunch of great work here. Of course, Peter Cameo is running for governor against Arnold, and unbelievable as it is, Phil Angelides looks like he is set to throw this race away. Just 9 months ago, Schwarzenegger's poll ratings were about as bad as Bush's, and he lost his entire referendum schema. And now Phil Angelides seems set to throw the race again, incredibly. We're running, we're doing our best to get the word out there. People should join in these campaigns. But I will just leave you with this, which is join our campaigns. But if you can hear this broadcast, it means that you're probably pretty close to San Francisco. And on August 12th, at 11 a.m., there's going to be a protest down at Civic Center Plaza to demand the end of the Israeli occupation of Lebanon and Gaza. And if we are ever to get anywhere in this country on anybody's questions, then we have to confront the American empire. And so please get out there on August 12th. It's, in my opinion, far more important than voting for me on November 6th. Bring your family, bring your friends, and go to the National Council of Arab Americans website to get all the information. And please do join us out there on August 12th, because that's only 7 or 8 or 9 days away. It's something you can do immediately to make a difference. And really, the Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim community of this country will appreciate everybody who comes out to that demonstration on August 12th. So thanks very much for having me here, David. I appreciate the chance to talk to your audience.
Our pleasure, Todd. Yeah. And again, if you'd like to get involved in the campaign, you're anywhere throughout the state of California, Todd for Senate, and use the numeral 4 as part of the website, toddforsenate.org. And get in touch and put your efforts to good use. There are any number of different ways that you can use these races for structural change, as well as educating the population. And if you'd like to host a fundraiser in your community for his campaign, you can certainly get in touch as well. The good cross-section of the state has got to be very very surprised at the madness that's passing for reality in modern politics. Well, you're listening to Indie Bay Radio here in San Francisco, and we'll go back to some good music. Let's see if we can find some Jack Chernos. He's been a pretty dedicated advocate of common sense, and he always has some great songs that kind of speak to the reality of the day.
You can throw off 50 cards at the window. The only thing from this train that'll ever be found, little lambs that trust what they're told. Every night, die out in the cold. It's time to turn this train around. For every cloud that passes, I miss one on the other side of the train. Turn Lift this train and head it home.